Right. So, what is oral history? Well, simply put, the practice of oral history is recording, and that's the important word, recording people's memories of the past. Or it can be actually attitudes about the present, but usually it's memories of the past. Within that, recording is the important word because we have the ability to record now. Sound recording, you can feel smug if you can remember when Edison invented his first phonograph. I can never remember exactly. I was in a school recently, and out came the iPad, and as I was talking 2 minutes later, 1875 came up, or whatever it was, which was very sharp. Before then, if you think about it, history was transmitted orally for a long, long time, but the ability to record it hasn't been around that long. Of course, when I started, it was reel-to-reel tape, magnetic tape. Now it's small pocket-sized digital recorders. But it's the recording of those memories. And of course, what you get when you do this is a mix. You get a mix of first-hand eyewitness memories of events. But mixed up within that, you get things people have heard, things people have been told, things people have seen in the media and things like that. Family or community traditions or myths or whatever you want. This could be a recipe being passed down through the generations within a family. Or it could be a community story that everybody tells everybody else within the community. People might not have witnessed it, but they've been told it. So you get this mix of what people have been told, what they've heard secondhand, and what they've actually witnessed themselves. And one of the things that you can do when you have one of these recordings is to go through and try and figure out what is firsthand, what's reported, what's told, and all the rest. A brief few words about the development of oral history. Formal oral history recordings started in the United States after the Second World War as a way of capturing the histories of the great and the good, admirals, generals. The general reason for this is one of the same reasons we do these sorts of recordings today. In the Second World War, the paper trail, the scribbled notes and things that were being left behind for the historian, the paper trail was getting less and less. People were using radio, things weren't being written down as much. So they thought, to get as complete a record as possible, we'll go out and speak to people and get their memories of what was happening. That started with the great and the good. In Europe, Scotland, other countries, it was more a folklore sort of thing. People were recording popular folk memories. And that's kind of how it started in England as well. One name that is often mentioned is George Ewart Evans, a Welshman who ended up in Suffolk. Went to a village fete, this is in the 1950s, saw the older people showing the younger people how they used to scythe and mow and that sort of thing, and realised there was a tradition, an oral tradition, that was going to die out with mechanisation, and went in and started recording it. And this tradition of sort of history from the bottom up, working class histories, that sort of women's histories, people who don't necessarily get represented in the mainstream histories, this tradition has stayed with oral history. And certainly in the 60s and 70s, there'd often be a political element, sort of advocacy element in what people were doing, and that still happens today. You record people's stories and you present them for a political purpose or another purpose. So that underlying current is still there in a lot of oral history, and this phrase, history from the bottom up, is often used. There's much more information about that on websites, which we can link to, and if anyone's interested, I will happily point you in the direction of it. However, the sort of HLF projects that you're involved with are still often a good example of that sort of project. The things you're engaged with often are subjects that just don't get tackled in mainstream history books, the sort of history books perhaps that come out of departments like this. So there's been this upsurge, particularly with lottery money in the last 10 to 15 years, of community local histories, of which you are very good examples. Very good examples. I've got my favourite phrase down here. George Ewart Evans coined this phrase, ask the fellows who cut the hay. If you want to know how it was done, go and ask the people who did it, which is still a good philosophy for what we're doing today. Of course, one of the things, which I'll move on to now, about oral history is that it's very dependent on memory. And for that reason, it's been looked down on in the past because memory is such a fickle thing. And I'm going to give you a memory test in a minute to see how good your memories are. But there's a few things that it's useful to know about memory if you are going out and doing some recording with people. The general idea behind memory at the moment is that it isn't like a strip of film or video, and you just have to rewind to that particular point, and there it all is. The general idea is it's more like a collage of things, and some parts of that collage you can access very well, some parts you can't. Sometimes you need cues to access your memories, sort of reminders. And it's very often in a recording, after about 20 or 30 minutes, or maybe at the end of it, people say, do you know, I didn't think I'd have much to talk about, but now I'm talking about it, now cues are coming, memory cues, I can remember a lot more, and I'm quite surprised by that. So, I'll actually read this, because it's simpler than me making it up. This is from Daniel Schachter, Chair of Psychology at Harvard University. We do not record our experiences the way a camera records them. We extract key elements from our experiences and store them. We then reconstruct our experiences rather than retrieve copies of them. At the same time, however, countless studies have shown that seemingly lost information can be recovered by cues or hints that remind us of how we initially encoded an experience. So each time you tell a story, you're reconstructing as you go along. Sometimes the way you tell that story may change depending on your current circumstances, depending on how you told it in the past. The core of the story stays pretty much the same usually. We've got people in our archive who were recorded on the same subject 10, 15 years apart. And if you listen to them, the core of what is being told remains pretty much the same. There are slight details in the way it's told and the emphasis and the stress that people give to different things. But unless someone's deliberately trying to mislead you, generally these stories stay fairly constant. It's just the way they're told sometimes change. So what do we remember? Well, we tend to remember things that are seen as exceptional, out of the ordinary, rather than as common or everyday. And let's have an example here. I use this example all the time, but with younger audiences, it's not working so well anymore. And you look so young, it might not work with you, but we'll see, shall we? Do you remember how you felt when you heard that Princess Diana had died? Probably. It might have been indifference. It might have been extreme sadness. I don't know. You probably remember how you felt. We're quite good at remembering feelings. We're not good at remembering dates, generally. So my next question to you is, do you remember what day of the week it was?
Sunday.
Oh, very good. There are a couple of puzzled faces looking at me on that one, but we've got Sunday, yes.
Only for other reasons.
Ah, exactly. Can I ask why then? Why
we were on holiday in the Lake District, and we got two small children who were sleeping in a bedroom next to us who couldn't get any children's television. Mum, there's no children's television. Yes, there is, don't be silly. And I can remember turning the television on, and my immediate thought was the Queen Mother had died. Because it didn't actually come up with Princess Diana straight away. And I remember going back into the bedroom and saying to myself, I think the Queen Mother's died. You know, but it wasn't. It was Princess Diana, so yeah.
And countless times when I ask this question, the people who remember it are those who have a story or an anecdote that's attached to it,
yeah.
Which is the story about the day Princess Diana died. Birthdays, that was our wedding day, and then Princess Diana died. It's that sort of thing. Do you remember what the date was?
It was bank holiday.
Oh, that's pretty good. I'm seeing some blank faces. We're not so good at dates, yeah. Okay, so that was a fairly big event. It'll mean different things to different people. It helps if you've got a story or an anecdote that helps fit that in. Do you remember what you were doing the weekend before?
Going on holiday, yeah. Getting ready to go.
Most of you won't remember because it was a run-of-the-mill August weekend. Unless it is the weekend we did that, and that was the weekend before Princess Diana died, which often crops up in groups like this, or birthdays. So often we remember things if there is something significant attached to it, which is quite often the sort of births, marriages, weddings, key events are often very good at getting people to think about the chronology of events and what happened where, and are there things attached to things that can help people remember.
But isn't it the place as much as anything?
It can be.
You know where you were when you heard that Kennedy was.
Yeah.
And that brings back to the other memories.
It could be place, it could be at what was happening at the time. It's often said that smell is a very good thing for getting memories going as well, asking people about what things smelt like. With big events, sometimes if you're there, there's physical sensation as well. There might be noise, you know, the air, the atmosphere. So there's all sorts of things that can help people or can trigger memories. As people do, I like using photographs to ask, because there's always a story behind a photograph that people can tell. So using objects to stir memories, whether it's maps, photographs, a shoe, a shirt, clothes are very good, fashion is quite good for getting people to sort of reconstruct and remember where they were and what they were doing. So all these things help our memories, help us reconstruct our memories. If something produced strong emotions at the time, shock, fear, happiness, we're more likely to remember those. There's also this idea about consolidating a memory. If it's something that you've gone over and over again, something that's been talked about a lot, family memories, community memories, a story that, for instance, the Titanic officer, we could probably recite that story in his sleep by now. So if we've gone over and over things and consolidated them, and key reference points from the past, I've mentioned sort of birthdays. I'm guessing most of us will remember our 21st or 18th birthdays better than we'll remember our 15th or 12th birthdays, unless there was something exceptional that happened on your 12th or 15th or 23rd birthday or whatever. So some things we will remember better than others. Right, just the other point to make about memory is that while you have your individual memory, for big events like 9/11, death of Princess Diana, things in the past like the Second World War, there is a school of thought that suggests that it's almost impossible to trust your own individual memory because it's been contaminated by the media and subsequent events. Almost impossible. I'll leave you to compare your memories of the past. I like doing this with family members, by the way. Comparing childhood memories with my sister's, and you often come up with completely contrary memories. You can agree that something was involved, but I've got a childhood, three of us, my sister and a childhood friend. We know the day we met when we were 4 or 5 years old that there was a box of crayons involved, but each one of us was the victim at the hands of the others. And I don't understand how that could be, because it was clearly me who was the victim on that occasion. So it's surprising how emphasis can change. So there's individual memory that may or may not be tainted by other things. I have to say, for the big events, that's probably true. However, if you're going to ask someone to give you some detail about the tools they used at work, there's very little that's going to be contaminating that memory, other than perhaps conversations with fellow colleagues and things like that. But so there's the individual memory, but there's also communal memories that we're all part of. And the example I give of this is a colleague who I used to work with who decided he was going to give a talk about the Second World War. And he went out into his first luncheon club, all people of, mainly women of a certain age, in front of him, and started to say, in the Second World War, once the blackout started, crime rates went through the roof. Murder, burglaries, muggings. It was a thieves' paradise. Britain had rarely seen anything like it, and you could feel a bubble of discontent in the audience. And eventually someone said, young man, you weren't there, and it wasn't like that. Now, it was like that. He's got the statistics to prove it, but it's not that communal memory that these people had, and it's not really a communal memory of the Second World War for many, many people. And there are various reasons for that. You don't advertise at the time, if you're the authorities, that crime rates have gone through the roof. It's not a good thing to advertise. It also isn't a comfortable memory for people to live with over the previous 60 years, and it doesn't tie in with all the media and the films, which are heroic, generally, that we've seen since. Now, this is a pretty quick summation of it. So there are sort of accepted communal memories that you... I don't know if any of you are going to be recording people who get together in clubs, luncheon clubs, drop-in centres, nursing homes, things like that, where people gather and they chat. You often find people coming up with a sort of shared version of events. Now, if you can find people who actually disagree with those shared versions of events, so much the better. Sort of dissenting voices from the commonly held beliefs. But that happens as well. You get communal memories that people tend to... And you get national stories and national myths. Every country has stereotypes, doesn't it? The bulldog spirit, the myth of the Blitz, that sort of thing. The neutral Swiss... Lots of other things like that. So there are sort of national stereotypes and stories that people tell about themselves as well. In some ways, when you go out and record people, what you're actually recording is not just what they remember, but it's how the past is remembered. What do people choose to talk about? What don't they talk about? What language do they use? How do they decide to talk about the past? So that's wrapped up in it as well. So you're actually getting quite a lot when you go out and record people. But in the midst of all of that, I don't think you should forget that you're also getting some good, hard history sometimes, particularly on those personal things that people have done, which I'm pretty convinced aren't influenced by the media and all the rest of it. Hosiery machinery is always what I think about. I did a series of interviews years ago with all men who worked with hosiery machines, made them, maintained them, and no one else was interested, frankly. Certainly their wives weren't, and occasionally they got together and chatted about it. But when they found someone who was actually genuinely interested, they opened up. And workplace history is often extremely interesting. You often get lots of really useful information. And to sort of wrap this up before I test your memories, sometimes it's the only way of getting information. Sometimes there are no other sources. I mean, obviously, if there are, you would use those as well. If you're recording memories of a place, a time, an event, or whatever, if you've got newspapers, if you've got diaries, if you've got maps, if you've got documents, of course you'd use those. If you've got other recordings, you can compare and contrast all the time, but sometimes there are no other sources. And this is particularly the case with, say, groups who have arrived in, let's say, Leicester in recent years. When the museum wanted to put on an exhibition about Somalis who had come into Leicester 10 years ago, they were only very recently arrived, and there really wasn't that much you could put in a museum. So you have to go out and talk to people and gather their experiences. So and that persists throughout oral history. Sometimes it is the only way of doing it. Right. So as someone doing oral history recording, it's a realisation of the fickleness of memory, and some things will be remembered better than others, and some things you may need to work out with cues and everything to get that coming out. If anyone is interested in following this up, I can point you in the direction of some good books and resources later on. But for the moment, we'll leave memory behind. It may come up again as we go on. Right.